You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. For the rest of this hour, how much do genes influence behavior? We've all heard of the nature versus nurture debate. It's been going on for generations. How much of our behavior is due to our genes? How much due to our environment? Can you really separate the two? And when the Human Genome Project came along, the race was on to find the genes thought responsible for many illnesses, scattered in with the news reports of genes linked to cancer or Alzheimer's, or tantalizing reports of maybe there's a fat gene or an aggression gene or a monogamy gene or even a gay gene, genes that seem to influence or control behavior. The discoveries seem to suggest that a simple tweak might be all that was needed to tame a savage beast or keep a philanderer home at night. Just a little tweak of the genes. Well, could changing behavior really be as easy as changing a single gene? Lots of people were and are skeptical. But now a new study this month makes the suggestion that at least in fruit flies, a single gene can change behavior. Scientists reported this month in the journal Cell that changing just one gene in a fly altered its sexual behavior. And in another experiment reported in the journal Science, researchers manipulated the DNA of the prairie vole, causing some of the animals to become more social. So how conclusive is this evidence for a gene behavior link? Joining me now to talk more about those studies and the role genes play in the behavior of flies, voles, maybe even humans, is my guest, Gene Robinson, director of the neuroscience program at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and the new elect to the National Academy of Sciences. Well, congratulations, Dr.
Thank you
Robinson.
Very much. Nice to be here, Ira.
You're welcome. Let's talk about the study, recent studies. Let's talk about the fruit fly study. That seems to have really shaken up a lot of people.
Well, sure. It's a really exciting study. The researchers have been focusing on a gene called the fruitless gene, which has been the subject of previous studies that really have linked it with the control of sexual behavior in the fruit fly. Mm-hmm. This is a gene that is in the category that the technical term for it is transcription factor. A more general description is that this is a gene that orchestrates and controls the production of many proteins. Mm-hmm. So right away we were forced to confront the idea that we can manipulate a single gene, but by no means is there a simple relationship between a single gene and a complex behavior.
Hello.
There's a lot of intervening biology.
Because of the proteins. Let's go back and decipher what happened in that study first. The researchers put that gene that codes for the male form of the protein, and they put it in a female fly, correct?
That's right.
And they found that the females were acting more like males.
Correct.
In what ways?
Well, in their courtship behavior. So males will court females, and so females that were given a male version of the gene were then acting more like males and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. So that tells us that if they have that version of the gene, they'll be sexually attracted to females no matter what sex they are.
That's right. And if you look carefully at the data, what you see is that it will be a probabilistic change. There will be an increase in the likelihood of responding in that way. It's by no means all or nothing.
Mm-hmm. And they had a whole bunch of different behaviors, tapping, singing, wing vibrating, all from that single gene change.
Yes, those are all part of the courtship behavior of the fruit fly, and so it would make sense that they would be connected in that way.
Mm-hmm. Did they put the female version of the gene into the male?
Yes.
And what did they get? Did they get similar reaction?
Yes, they get a similar reaction. Yep, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the vole study, too. That seems a little bit more complicated. What were the researchers working with? Vasopressin receptor gene.
That's right. Yeah, so it's a gene that encodes a protein that then allows a particular hormone to do its thing in the brain, to work in the brain. So it takes the receptor for the hormone to work.
Mm-hmm. And tell us what happened.
So what was done in this study was there was the observation made that there's variation in the length of a part of the genome that's just before where this gene is located on the genome. And variation in the length of a particular region of the genome was correlated with differences in the tendency to have social behavior, a particular form of social behavior, which was a kind of a bonding type behavior in the laboratory. And then manipulations of that region of the genome could cause changes in behavior.
Whether the vole was a good parent or not depended on that form of gene.
Yeah, they didn't do any real parenting assays, but they did the kind of bonding that you would expect would have that kind of repercussion down the line. They looked at how much time a male spends with a female that it has mated with previously. And males with the longer version of that piece of DNA spent more time with the female that they mated with previously than did males with the shorter version, mm-hmm. suggesting that they would be bonding with that individual and perhaps be more monogamous.
Any way to translate the results of these two studies into higher animal or even human behavior yet?
Well, no. Certainly they provide the kind of information that we want from model system research, from research on selected animal species. They're providing the kind of interesting insights, provocative insights that would fuel future research that would address the issues that you raised on humans. But at this point, we don't have enough to go on, and certainly it would be something that we would want to move with great caution. The big difference, of course, is the role of culture in shaping patterns of human behavior. And so we would love to know whether indeed this biological mechanism has the same role and is giving this sort of, let's say, signal, and then how strong does this signal exist when it's sort of juxtaposed perhaps with other other signals that are coming from a different domain, like a cultural domain.
Mm-hmm. But this would this fruit fly study would certainly put some heavy weight into the nature version here versus the nurture side.
Yes, indeed. But, you know, it's important to think about nature-nurture in a way that doesn't polarize questions about genes. So when we say nature and nurture, we're really not talking about genes versus the environment. Genes can be involved in transmitting hereditary influences on behavior, and they can also be involved in environmental influences. So you can have environmental influences on gene expression, and you can have hereditary influences on gene expression. Both factors, this sort of nature nurture, which sound, you know, like apples and oranges, both in fact are acting on the same substrate on the genome.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. What I also found interesting about the vole study was that the genetic differences were found in what we used to call junk DNA.
Yes, you're right. That's interesting. It's an old term, and it's quickly going out of fashion as discoveries that were fueled by the Human Genome Project and genome projects of other species have been leading to just marvelous discoveries, finding all sorts of roles for pieces of DNA that are in between the genes, the so-called junk DNA, that are now found to affect when a gene is expressed, where a gene is expressed, and how much of the gene is expressed, how active is the gene expression, how much of the protein product is produced. So we're really learning a lot about these other areas of the genome that don't encode proteins. And they're important.
Maybe not junk after all.
Exactly.
1-800-989-8255. Chris in New Jersey. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, go ahead.
I just wanted to make the point that in the vole study with montane and prairie voles, it was only one hormone that was making the change between monogamous and promiscuous species. And in human beings, there's a lot more factors and neurotransmitters and hormones that go into, and as well as environmental factors that go into.
Good point. Would you agree, Doctor?
Yes, indeed. The biology can be more complex. Voles also have multiple hormones. It's not the only hormone that's present in the voles. So we see a lot of complexity in the vole system. And for many years, rodents have been great models for studies in neuroendocrinology and behavioral neuroendocrinology in particular.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Chris. Thanks for calling. And I guess in a sense, finding a gene for a specific condition or behavior like this monogamy, you might be able to say, hey, this relieves me of a responsibility to act the way I should be. Blame it on my gene.
Yes.
Or if you're fat, I have a fat gene. Or, you know, or if I'm aggressive, I have an aggression gene.
Well, I teach a class in genes and social behavior here at the University of Illinois, and the way I begin the class every semester is by saying that with respect to behavior, genes are boring. Genes simply encode proteins. That's what they do. Now, the really interesting frontier is how do the proteins combine to form neural circuits, to form molecular pathways, to give the brain the ability to produce behavior and to produce flexible patterns of behavior. So the gene is very, very far removed from the behavior. I say to my students, there are no fat genes, there are no mean genes, there are no smart genes. The genes just simply encode proteins. And then it's the action of the protein working with many, many other proteins that then give rise to behavior. Mm-hmm. So it's far removed.
Let's go to Kathleen in Nashville. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi there. How are you all?
Fine. How are you?
Fine. Thank you. My sister and I are very much the same in ways of our parenting, and our husband's very much the same. We have each have a son who is gay. However, my son that's gay is adopted. And however, he did tell me, you know, I remember my son telling me, you know, this is not a choice that I ever made. No one would ever choose this for himself. He himself seems to feel like it's genetic. So, but the fact that my sister and I both seem to raise a son who's gay seems to lend itself more towards the nurturing. So I wanted to get your opinion.
You don't think your son is right that he has a...
Well, I do.
He's uncontrolled.
I think he definitely feels as though this was not a choice that he made.
But you say it's something that you did to him.
Well, it just seems like my sister and I both raised our sons kind of the same way. However, I do also have another son, my biological son, who's not gay. So
what did you do differently for him, do you think?
Absolutely. I don't think anything.
Hmm. Well, let's
I don't think anything.
Dr. Robinson?
Well, we're talking about a trait that has very complex roots. The fact that there are biological roots is certainly very well supported by twin studies that have been conducted in a variety of labs. And so I think it's probably very difficult to extrapolate much from the really small sample size that we're talking about right now. So it's just really difficult to say much more than just the observation that you made.
Well, and also I just from noting from my son that the different kinds of parenting of gay children seems to have an effect on how they relate or react to their sexual orientation, as far as, you know, being more flamboyant or being more conservative. He seems to have found that to be the case, but not that that they had anyone had a choice in their sexual orientation. So thank you very much. Appreciate that.
You're welcome. We're talking about the genes this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Jean Robinson, who is director of neuroscience program at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I think, you know, that people keep looking for, you know, of course, homosexuality is a big topic, and people are still wrestling with this: is there a gay gene or not?
Yep, people are wrestling with that. There was some early research a number of years ago that suggested that there was a region of the genome, a gene itself had not been identified, but a region of the genome in which variation in that region was correlated. I haven't seen anything recently on that topic, so I'm not really sure where that research stands. Mm-hmm. So it created a splash about 10 years ago, and I think that there hasn't been a whole lot done in that area since. And in contrast, certainly the work on the voles and the fruit flies, these that were papers that we're talking about today, are the culmination of very nice research programs that have been done on these genes for some time.
And so how would a scientist now move this forward to a next step? Where do you take this and move on to, you know, for other tests and other studies?
Well, one of the big questions in the fruitless story is, since the fruitless encodes a protein which is, as I said before, a transcription factor orchestrating other proteins, the question is, who is fruitless talking with? What proteins are interacting with fruitless? How do they work together to create aspects of the fly nervous system that show these sex-specific differences? So that's a really big question, identifying the genes or the proteins that are involved with fruitless. That's something that's really very important.
And in the vole side?
In the vole side, well, there's a hint of a really interesting new direction at the very end of the paper, and that is looking at the DNA sequences of primates and looking for similarities and differences in this same region of the genome that was looked at for the vole, to get some ideas of whether there are strong differences, consistent differences that are species-specific there in lineages of primates, and then to sort of look at the differences in primate social behavior. So it's just something that was done at the very end of the paper, just to sort of looked like a beginning of something. And I think that could be a very interesting line of research. What we have now is because we have the genomes of multiple organisms being sequenced, we have the ability to look at regions of the genome that are otherwise very difficult to study, the regions that don't encode the genes themselves. And so we're, you know, with our genome sequencing projects, we have the ability to look there and sort of develop a stronger comparative base, which can then lead to new experiments.
Thank you very much, Dr. Robinson, for taking time to talk with us.
Sure. It was a pleasure to be on the show, Ira.
Gene Robinson, Director of the Neuroscience Program at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and Senior Producer Karen Berghoff. Charles Berquist is our director and our web producer. Our intern for our program is Todd Neal. Surf over to sciencefriday.com if you missed any of the links. You can also download Science Friday's Kids Connection. Press on the teachers button there. For teachers, you'll get a free curricula that we make out of Science Friday, teaching materials you can use in your classrooms. Also, we're podcasting Science Friday. You can do that or listen on your Audible player or on your Real Audio player. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flato in New York.